Good morning, and thank you so much for joining another episode of Mission Health Partners podcast. Today, we are going to be having a conversation on breast screenings, and we have with us today Dr. Rachel McEachern with Asheville Radiology Associates, as well as Dr. Amy Russell, the Medical Director for Mission Health Partners. So if you would both like to introduce yourself, and then we can get on into the conversation.
Great. Thank you, Kristen. Thank you for joining us. I'm Dr. Amy Russell, the Medical Director for Mission Health Partners, and we invited Dr. McEachern here today to talk about cancer screening. As you guys know, it's really important for us to get our patients screened. And there have been a variety of different recommendations out there. And so she's going to talk specifically about those recommendations. She is fellowship trained as a breast radiologist and has a lot of information to provide for us.
Thanks so much. So like Amy Russell said, I am a breast radiologist. I did a fellowship and practice with Asheville Radiology and Mission, primarily doing breast imaging. So today what I would like to do is kind of talk about the different screening recommendations, why there's such a variety, and kind of go through density and what risk means and how we can provide that information to help you and us better serve these patients. So starting off with the first slide is just the variety of
share the screen here. Hold on one second. There we go.
All righty. So here we can see there's a somewhat of a broad range in terms of what are the current recommendations by various governing bodies that we all subscribe to. So probably the most or the largest variation would be between the USPSTF and the ACP. Versus ACR and SBI, which is the American College of Radiology and Society of Breast Imaging, as well as the NCCN guidelines and the American Society of Breast Surgeons. So the USPSTF guidelines, as you know, recommend screening with a B recommendation at 50 with biannual screening until the age of 70. And ACP does as well, I'm sorry, to 74. And the ACP does as well, except the variation is that the ACP says stop screening when there's no more than 10 years of life expectancy left. The American College of Radiology says start screening annually at 40 and stop when there's about 5 to 7 years of life expectancy left. Some organizations don't provide a kind of a termination of when you should stop screening, but the NCCN, Society of Breast Surgeons, ACOG, and ACS all have the idea that you should begin screening at 40 with the caveat that ACOG recommends that it be offered, but definitely initiated by 50. And ACS says to all between 40 and 45, but to initiate by 45. So the variation, probably, like I said, most likely the discrepancy that most people care about is what the radiologists are going to say versus what the primary care group is promoting as their recommendations. And in doing a lot of reading about why there's variation, it kind of, I think, comes down to that the USPSTF in their last revision in 2016 really looked at randomized or controlled trials, so RCTs. And we know that those tend to underestimate mortality benefit because you're talking about efficacy versus effectiveness. So women that are invited to screen versus women that actually do screen. And those RCTs that they looked at primarily were done many years ago with different technology than what we have today in terms of breast screening. So a mammogram is, yes, it is a mammogram, but not all mammograms are created equal. A lot of the trials that the USPSTF looked at involved film screen, and there was a big jump in quality of imaging when we went from film screen to digital. which happened in the early 2000s. And then even a bigger quality jump when we went from digital, meaning that I can window and level and look through things versus hanging a film in a view box, to tomosynthesis, which allows me to look through a patient's breast tissue and really potentially uncover hiding cancers. One could argue that the USPSTF in particular didn't have any breast cancer specialists on their panel when they did do their revisions in 2016. So there was not a breast imager, there was no breast surgeon or an oncologist. So while these recommendations are being provided to primary care doctors, one could argue that engagement of specialists in this field could be important. And also, when we talk about women that are 40 to 49, the USPSTF gave a level C category recommendation, which could potentially harm those women that do want to be screened between the age of 40 and 49. When you look at the recommendations from all bodies, they all say that the most lives are saved when we start screening at 40. And currently, the USPSTF is undergoing guideline revisions. They had an opening from the public for commentary, and I'm interested to see what ultimately results from their revisions. Why does the American College of Radiology and the Society of Breast Surgeons and NCCN recommend screening at 40? So when we talk about the role of breast cancer screening, at least from my perspective, is that I want to find the earliest cancer. So that means that there's less likely of nodal metastasis or more distant metastasis. The treatment is less intensive, less use of chemotherapy, less use of mastectomies. And so when we talk about how the USPSTF really relied on RCTs, that, you know, what happens when somebody is invited to screen, not is actually screened. So observational studies are best at looking at that. And there are two that are often quoted. One was from British Columbia, which looked at women from 40 to 49 that were actually screened and demonstrated a 26% mortality reduction. The other is one that was done through Sweden. And the nice thing about Sweden is that they are, you know, a completely governmental, all have access to healthcare. So the variation is very measurable. So different counties in Sweden can determine whether or not they want to start screening at 40 or 50. And they found that there was an estimated 18% reduction when women started screening at 40 in mortality. We do know that 1 in 6 breast cancers will be diagnosed in a woman that is between the age of 40 to 49. So it's not an insignificant amount. And, you know, some people will say, well, why not start screening earlier? We know that the incidence of breast cancer essentially doubles in a patient population of 35 to 39 versus 40 to 44. So that's when we start to see the most or, you know, becomes more beneficial to screen, and where we would see the most life years gained in those young women. And when we talk about the USPSTF guidelines in terms of why they say that, you know, there obviously there are negative consequences of screening as well. There are false positives from screening, unnecessary recalls, so to say, you know, they don't lead to a cancer diagnosis. So when looking at our practice here in Asheville, we have about an 8% recall rate from screening mammography. National benchmarks are between 5 and 10, so we're kind of right in the middle, which is great. We know that of those women screened, approximately 2% will have or need a biopsy, and 20 to 40% of those women will get a diagnosis of cancer. So while there are negatives in the sense that we call back women that may not have cancer, it is a screening test to where I need to make sure that what I'm looking at isn't cancer, and I may need to do a few additional diagnostic pictures, not necessarily a biopsy. And most women, there was a study in JAMA that talked about women wanted wanted to know if they were getting screened. They wanted to make sure that they didn't have cancer as best they could. So I think the small negative of having a recall is certainly outweighed by making sure the patient doesn't have cancer. Another thing they talked about is overdiagnosis. There are some, you know, reports of cancers that go away. That doesn't happen. But what really I think is the more scientific question is overdiagnosis, and specifically that of related to ductal carcinoma in situ, which is the non-invasive form of cancer. And just like the invasive form of breast cancer, there are grades. So in particular, looking at ductal carcinoma in situ of that is of low grade, and the likelihood that that will progress to something that is meaningful, such as an invasive cancer that has the ability to metastasize and then cause mortality. So there's a current trial going on with called the COMET trial, which is basically looking at, you know, standard guidelines versus active surveillance with potential endocrine therapy. And that, I believe, is in a phase 3 trial. But we, as a medical community, have not really figured out what triggers some ductal carcinoma in situ to become invasive, and what does not, you know, what the ones that don't become invasive, what are they missing or what do they have? So it's difficult to predict based on a biopsy, but I think that the COMET trial will certainly allow us to potentially pull back some of the treatment recommendations, in particular for the low-grade DCIS. And the third thing that the USPSTF talks about is radiation risk. I think that the small dose that a woman gets from a screening mammogram is very minimal compared to any other radiology test that we may order, and the likelihood of it evolving or causing a radiation-related breast cancer is non-existent. So this is kind of where we get a lot of questions, kind of migrating from talking about the different screening recommendations to what is breast density, what is lifetime risk, how are these calculated, and what does that information, how do we educate our patients so that they can take that information and be screened as they desire, and why are there these recommendations? So when we talk about density, it's the percentage of fibroglandular tissue relative to a background of fat. So on this slide to the right, you can see that this is a excerpt from a paper, but basically on the far left of this series of images, that's a completely fatty breast. So mostly black, minimal white breast tissue. Easy to find the cancer, especially when there's an arrow sign, but easy to find the cancer. As you progress, there's more fibroglandular tissue, which makes it more difficult to see a cancer on a screening mammogram because the cancers are also white. So the breast tissue acts as a camouflage, unfortunately. And we know that women that have higher breast density, particularly the high C's and D's, so the second from the right and the far right, meaning their breast tissue density is, you know, above 50% relative to fat, that those women are going to be more likely to have tumors that are of larger size at time of diagnosis, just because of the MAP effect. And so when we talk about density in our reports, you will often see categories A, B, C, or D, or fatty, scattered, fatty, scattered, heterogeneous, or dense. And those are just in quartiles. So quartiles of breast tissue relative to fat, which then also implies the likelihood that a cancer may be masked by the patient's breast tissue. So that's density. And then when we talk about risk, so risk can be a genetic mutation carrier. It can be because there's a family history that is significant without a known genetic mutation. It can also be because a patient had lymphoma as a child and had chest wall or mantle cell radiation. They've had a prior biopsy of lobular neoplasia, which would include atypical lobular hyperplasia or lobular carcinoma in situ, or a biopsy showing atypical ductal hyperplasia. There are some other risks that are less, but early menarche, late menopause, so longer exposure to estrogen, obesity, particularly in the postmenopausal patient, not having any children, or as well as alcohol consumption. And we also know that breast density in and of itself increases your risk of having breast cancer. So there are a lot of different risk models, and I won't belabor that point or get into that, but typically, and what we're using in our clinic and trying to begin a risk assessment formally in our clinic is the Tyrer-Cuzick 8 model, which takes into account all these things. But if you wanted to do a risk assessment in your clinic or for your patient, I've linked a website that has a free risk assessment for which uses the Tyrer-Cuzick 8, and that is something that you can ask questions of the patient regarding their family history, menarche, menopause, breast density, and that sort of thing, and it will generate a number. And so currently the number 20% or greater lifetime risk is what would qualify a patient as being at elevated lifetime risk for breast cancer, and it's in those women that we would recommend doing supplemental screening for risk. If we want to go to the next slide, it's kind of a good algorithm in terms of screening patients in general and how we kind of think about it. So density and risk are interrelated but often thought of as separate. So in a woman of average or intermediate risk, so less than 20% lifetime risk on a Tyrer-Cuzick model, and their A or B density, we would say just get your annual screening mammogram, preferably 3D or tomosynthesis, and that's great. That's all you need to do. If you are still of average or intermediate risk and you are of the higher quartiles of breast density, so C or D or heterogeneously or extremely dense, we would recommend getting your annual screening mammogram. And if the patient wanted to do more, we can talk about the benefits of doing automated whole breast ultrasound, weighing the risks and benefits of, false positives, cost of screening tests, but also cancer detection. And the way that I like to explain ABUS to patients is that get a screening mammogram, cancer is white, breast tissue is white, it's easier for it to hide. But on an ultrasound, cancers are often black while breast tissue is white. So those cancers that are invasive are a lot easier for us to see on ultrasound, which is why we use those only in our dense patients, not in our lower density patients. So that's talking about density and average risk. And then when we talk about patients that are known to be at elevated risk for breast cancer, the current societal guidelines would say start screening mammography at age 30, and then starting breast MRI between 25 and 30 if they're known at the time to be high risk at that point in their life with an annual MRI. That caveat is that obviously MRIs are expensive and certainly useful in certain patient populations, but in those women that where cost is important, as is probably the majority of the population, or claustrophobia is an issue. Here in town, we have something called contrast enhanced mammography, which uses iodinated contrast, which is the type of CT contrast, and basically gives us a quick and dirty version of an MRI. I actually have a picture of it on the next slide that would be helpful to see. So an alternative to an MRI is a contrast enhanced mammogram, not considered entirely standard of care given that it is a new technology and we're still learning about the sensitivity and specificity, but the data that we do have suggests that it's pretty similar and might be even more specific. This is a nice picture of a woman, so category D, who had a actually had a pacemaker, so couldn't have an ABUS. So she elected to have a contrast enhanced mammogram. And so we use physics to manipulate visualization of the breast parenchyma on the quote unquote subtracted image, which is the image that you see on the right side of the two stacked images side by side, and that little area of enhancement in the lateral breast. So top part of the screen on the left side, and then towards the back behind the nipple on the right side of the screen was a invasive ductal carcinoma grade 2 that we probably would have missed this year had we not had this test available to this patient. And then also going back to that screening algorithm on the prior slide, women that have a personal history of breast cancer with elevated breast density, so CRD, or those diagnosed under the age of 50, we do recommend annual screening MRIs as well as mammograms to help aid in detection of subsequent or additional cancers. So when to stop screening, at least, you know, greater than 75 years old, we really want to think about what is the life expectancy of these patients, and would they be able or willing or have any desire to have the required treatment for breast cancer? Because if they're wheelchair bound and have a lot of other things going on, I don't think that their breast cancer is going to be their focus, and I understand that. And so it's a discussion that needs to be had by somebody that sees the patient and kind of knows more of their medical history. But we certainly do that in clinic when we wind up to the point where after screening exam, there's an abnormality seen. I certainly counsel patients on that as well, if it is appropriate given their age and comorbidities. And then if we want to move to this, so another kind of switching gears a little bit, in terms of what we are doing at Asheville Radiology and Mission, we have recently made a universal order form that should help patients move through the process a little smoother, reduce their wait times. And this is particularly geared towards patients that are not of power chart doctors, where they've clicked in power chart that we can do the exams that we see necessary. And this really helps us do the exams that are necessary, but not do the exams that are unnecessary, and move patients through clinic quicker, which in the time of COVID is paramount for social distancing. And if anyone has any questions or wants access to this form, please feel free to email myself or Joe Jafrida, who's one of our practice managers, and we can get this to you.
Yeah, Dr. McEachern, we can put it on our Mission Health Partners webpage so people can access it. And for those physicians, those practices, almost all are moving towards electronic referrals. This could be a guide to the components that you add to your electronic referral. So it's helpful tool for you to use as you're setting up that process.
Okay, wonderful. And then the last thing that is kind of very new and hot off the press. So COVID vaccination started earlier in, you know, at the beginning of this year. And something that we started seeing was unilateral axillary lymphadenopathy on the side of patients who had gotten their COVID vaccine. And in particular, as this has migrated into our screening population, we are noticing it more and more nationwide. It's been noticed. And so the Society of Breast Imaging has released a physician statement saying that if you have had the COVID vaccine, that we would wait 4 to 6 weeks from your last dose. So second dose for Pfizer, Moderna, singular dose vaccine if Johnson & Johnson gets approved, 4 to 6 weeks after that. And I know that not always, you know, the COVID vaccines are not coming from our primary care doctors, and they're not as, you know, it's not like you have knowledge of when your patients are there, but it's just, this is kind of my PSA to try and help patients not have a false positive screening mammogram because they have enlarged axillary adenopathy, which happens to be due to their vaccine, in an effort to reduce the number of additional tests that patients may need or think that they need on their screening mammogram, which turns out to just be vaccine related. And we are making efforts to our scheduling to help encourage patients to schedule these appropriately so we don't see this problem. And that's all I have.
Great, thank you so much. I have a few questions. You know, we are monitoring our screening processes, particularly for Medicare. And we know that as a network, we're averaging about 79 to 80% screening rates. And this is screening for women over 50 every 2 years. So it's not even the more guideline-based related to this discussion. It's not annual screening. It's every 2 years, and we're still missing about 20% of patients. So I think the conversations that we're also interested in is how to meet the needs of that population and what are the barriers to care. I think the example of some standing orders and referral processes that help make that process easier. Obviously, the COVID pandemic has been a barrier for some patients, but even prior to that, we had a lot of women who weren't getting screening. So I think keeping that in mind, and I don't know, Dr. McEachern, if you have anything to say specifically about that.
Women can, so access to care is obviously important. Women can self-schedule, but that obviously takes initiative from the patient to do that. They just have to have a physician that they can, or that's willing to accept the results should they come back abnormal. And most, you know, if they are insured or on Medicare or Medicaid, those bodies based on the ACA should be able to get annual screening mammograms for free. It's one of the screening tests that are covered within those organizations and those insurance companies. So it's, that should be easy. You know, in the world of COVID, we used to have more outreaches prior to it, but that's kind of been nixed for obvious reasons, but certainly something that we would like to do moving forward once we eventually return to a state of normal at some level.
I'd love for you to comment a risk assessment process. You know, in primary care, we, you know, and guidelines are evolving as we've discussed. Things have changed over the past few years, and they're likely to continue to evolve as new imaging and studies are available. From the perspective of how patients go through the system and understand their risk and the types of studies they should be getting and how we make sure those are ordered correctly. Tell us a little bit about how we can improve on that process or what you're doing to make sure patients are appropriately risk stratified.
So I totally understand that risk assessment is not something that most primary care doctors have when they're trying to see the number of patients that they need to see in a day. We are currently working on implementing a full Tyrer-Cuzick 8 risk assessment for all of our screening patients. So if they are at above average risk, so greater than 20%, that will be communicated to the provider. Also, we have onboarded Heather Mann, who's a PA who has a longstanding history with Asheville Radiology, but in the interventional world, on with our breast radiologist. And she will be working eventually with seeing patients who are high risk and what they might need. So do they need to see a surgeon who typically manages hormonal therapy, discusses risk reduction with surgery, et cetera, or are they not interested in that and we can just give them an imaging prescription, what would be indicated based on their risk, et cetera. And then also with women that are of average risk or intermediate risk, but that have increased breast density, having that discussion with them about what additional supplemental screening would mean, what we would recommend, and the benefits versus the risks of doing additional screening in terms of finding additional cancers, but also false positives.
How do you recommend that we do, how should we approach genetic screening in populations that are high risk?
So I think that's something else we're working on in getting genetic testing. I think if you're looking at breast cancer, you really want to hone in on patients that have had either have a significant family history of breast cancer, ovarian cancer, colon cancer, pancreatic cancer. Those are the cancers associated primarily with the BRCA1, BRCA2 genes. I know that Fullerton Genetics in town can be difficult to get into, but ideally we would like to be able to provide that screening as well to the patients when they're getting their screening mammogram. And if they elect to then have the genetic testing, have the ability for them to do that in the clinic. And then once either they test positive, then we can send them to a genetic counselor, versus if they test negative, then at least that provides some reassurance. And the counseling would be provided in our office as well.
Great. Well, that's all the questions I have. Is there anything else you have to hear?
No, I think we covered it. And if anybody else has any additional questions, I'm always happy to answer them or talk to anyone.
Great. Thank you so much. Appreciate your feedback and your presentation, and look forward to talking to you soon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.